Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos.
Yeah, right. Crazy.
And welcome to episode 141, especially the Patreon supporters, because without them we wouldn't be able to produce this podcast. And it is a podcast which is free for everyone, but it's self-funded, and if you like what you hear, please do go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram page, find their Linktree drop-down box, and follow the link to Patreon. That said, back to today's episode. I'm shortly going to introduce you to Anthony Garrett. It's another one of those episodes that got recorded months ago. Anthony was supposed to be part of the Kensington and Chelsea Art Week, but in this episode, Anthony will tell you why that didn't happen. Anthony splits his time between painting and creating public artworks. Obviously, it was the public artworks that he was going to show in the Kensington and Chelsea Art Week. Now, I don't really want to do any spoilers in the intro about Anthony's work, but it is absolutely beautiful and full of empathy and care for others. And he's also a bloody great guy. But don't just take my word for that. Come along with me over Zoom to meet Anthony Garrett.
It was all going ahead, and then I was literally driving down to install it. Like, I had a boot full of gas and the letters and everything. I had a phone call from Vestalia saying the Parks Authority had cancelled it on that day, saying that they weren't sure the grass would grow back. So...
And I presume you've done it several times before.
Oh, yeah, I've tested it loads. It's absolutely fine. It recovers in about 2 weeks. But I guess that's the nature of the beast. It's something that people haven't done before, I guess. So there's a risk attached to it.
Yeah.
And people get a bit nervous of that. So, but we're trying to find other venues now, and hopefully it'll happen in another vein. But, yeah, a bit of a shame. But it'll happen. It's probably going to happen in Manchester and in Cornwall, and I'm hoping it will still happen as part of the festival. But, yeah, we'll see. It's part of the risk with public art, isn't it? You never know what's going to happen. So,
yeah. So I don't know if you've had the opportunity to listen to any of these.
Yeah, I love them. They're amazing. Yeah, amazing. No, I really, actually, you've kind of got me into podcasts, to be honest, because I hadn't really listened to them, and then I've really got into them. I loved your Maggie Hambling one, especially the bit where you sit on a sculpture.
Oh, man, she's, yeah, she was fucking scary.
It reminds me of when my little son was about 2 months old, and I thought I'd venture out and see a show. And I went to see Ai Weiwei's show at the Royal Academy.
Yeah.
I was wandering around, and he had that, you know, the concrete steel reinforcement bars all piled up in the seismic chart. And I put Walt down for a second just out of the carrier and kind of just adjusted myself. And I heard this massive crashing noise, and he basically crawled up that sculpture, and all these steel rods were rolling. Oh, shit. Security guard came running over and we kind of agreed that maybe Iwobi would have quite liked that anyway, so it was all right. But I had to kind of rearrange them as though it was like... I just remember, do you know the Golden Heart pub in Spitalfields?
Oh, of course, yeah, very much.
Yeah, so. I used to drink there a lot, and it was when Tracy Emin used to drink there, and she had fallen over on the floor, and she was a bit hammered and, like, on the floor, and I was like, someone trace round her, and it'd be a trace of Emin.
Oh, that's good.
Which also didn't happen, but...
No, but it should do, shouldn't it? Well, and I've got seven questions I ask each artist. Cool. The first being, how would you explain what you do to someone that doesn't know your work?
It'd probably take quite a while. I think I'd explain that I've got two hats as an artist. So I've got a painting hat, and then I've got my kind of public art hat. And they're two very different worlds. So it's a slightly unusual career because I enjoy both for different reasons. My painting is sort of something I can do for about 2 days, and then I need to do something else. So that I sort of collaborate with people and make public artworks as well. So it's kind of play, I guess. Mostly just play, which sounds bizarre as a job.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. Nice. Who wouldn't want that job?
Exactly.
You say you paint for 2 days. Is that, and you've had enough? Is that because it's so intense and takes up so much mind space, or is it the physical?
Yeah, I think I actually find it kind of exhausting. I paint quickly. I'm not a kind of dweller, really. I'm not a technical painter. So I think the idea needs to happen quite quickly, and they need to be executed in quite a fresh way.
Yeah.
If I spend too much time in front of them, I gradually kind of wreck them, and I need to come back. So it's just kind of a natural process. But I also just enjoy working with other people. Like, the collaboration thing's quite important. So working with, you know, musicians or poets or whatever. So rather than just being in my hovel, getting too involved in my painting, which is pretty bad for my brain, I think I like to get involved with other people as well.
And what collaborations are they?
Total mixture. They started off as placing giant paintings out in the landscape. So for instance, on Snowdon in Wales, I put a 5-meter painting on a raft in the middle of the lake. So that involved like shipbuilders who were able to build this raft, like, you know, technical people who knew what a building, that's not me. Quite an unusual brief. Got to carry like a big like a raft up Snowdon on the old miners track and then launch it into the middle of the lake.
As you do.
And that was to do with the mining industry there and the kind of retirement of the mining industry. So the painting was made in copper and iron that kind of oxidized over the season.
Nice.
And there was another one of those down a slate mine 500 feet underground. So they kind of rotted almost together.
Yeah.
And then in contrast to that, I've put together mass painting installations. So that's getting as many people as I can together, almost like flash mob style painting the same thing. So I got almost 1,000 people along the Cornish coast between Land's End and Senen painting the same subject. Ranging from kids to elderly people to professional artists. And that was about like connecting people with what they're looking at emotionally. I don't know if you find this, but like when you paint something or draw something, you build a bond with it. So
definitely.
It's a good way of kind of like getting kids to engage with, say, the landscape or the environment or issues. So so total range. And then, paintings that spin in the wind for a shipwreck and then compose music as they do so.
Oh, no, I didn't know that about the painting in question. And this is one that really pricked my ears. It was about the ship, the Royal Charter.
That's right, yeah.
Could you just tell us about that whole project and maybe a little bit of the history?
Yeah, for sure. So the Royal Charter was a big storm, especially on the island of Anglesey off North Wales. And it inspired Fitzroy to basically invent the shipping forecast to prevent another disaster like that, where I think 400 people died on Anglesey on the Royal Charter ship. And it was a steamship which was going from Melbourne to Liverpool, and it got hit by the storm and wrecks on Anglesey near Mulfra. And I was commissioned to make a piece of art to kind of commemorate on the 160th anniversary of that wreck.
Yeah.
So it's to do with the shipping forecast and also the wreck. So I made a giant 5x3 meter painting. Brilliant. That was basically like a giant weather vane. And on one side, there was a painting of the storm hitting the boat. On the other side was a calm day at sea. So depending on the prevailing wind direction, you'd see the storm or the calm because it would spin. But inside that was a little data encoder that sent a bit of data every day at 5 to 6, the time of the shipping forecast.
Nice.
And that was turned into a musical note And then on the anniversary of the wreck, a Welsh male voice choir and a violinist played the music that was composed.
Oh, man, it's beautiful.
So it was really moving. Like, everyone was in tears, really. Partly because the music was sounding so awful. well, because it was composed by the wind and not a human.
It was just random notes.
Random notes all in a non-phrase. So it was, yeah, it was cool, but weird. Quite haunting, though. And, yeah, we managed to find the old bell from the Royal Charter boat, which was obviously dived and, you know, brought up from the sea. And so for the choir to use that in performance as well was really
amazing. And they used it too.
Yeah, so that kind of broke the phrases of music. And then the ex-poet laureate for Wales, Gillian Clark, wrote a poem which was read halfway through the performance as well. So that was like a collaboration with loads of different, you know, musicians, poets, engineers, which I loved.
Oh, man, it's beautiful. And I like the way that you had said that it creates a sense of roulette.
Yeah.
And that's, that's true, isn't it, you know?
Yeah. And, yeah, depending, because there are kind of two prevailing wind directions on the coast, so it was kind of switching between those two.
Wow.
So a lot of the notes were kind of like, dung, 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 which developed over time. So there's loads of chance to do with it, but I love that about the risk involved in putting something big and flat out in the landscape, like a painting, you know, it's a big sail, basically.
And is it still there?
It's come down now. I thought it was important that it was temporary, because it was about the anniversary and that one event. Yeah. So somehow it staying up became a bit too much of a statement, if you know what I mean.
No, go on, please.
Then you get involved in kind of planning and all that stuff as well. So because it was a temporary structure, it sort of keeps it simple.
I was going to say, how long was the length of music?
About 3 or 4 minutes.
And how long did it take to create that?
60 days.
Wow.
So, which was the time it took the ship to get from Melbourne to the island. So we stopped recording after
that. Oh, man. Oh, yeah. just layers and layers of interest.
Lots of funny little details. But yeah, it was really moving. Like every stage of it was really emotional, I think.
Yeah.
Which was great. And it interrupted, there's a little coast path around Anglesey on that. So it interrupted that walk and made people stop. And I think that's the important part about public art, isn't it? It's like interrupting the humdrum of life just to, you know, be shocked or surprised or hate something or love it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm all for the story behind the artwork.
Mm.
And, you know, like you was just saying there, that's what made me think of it. Just getting people to stop. Come out of their little world, come off of their train track and just pay attention to something for a few moments. Mm. It can bloody change the way someone thinks, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, not just look at it and say, oh, that's worth a lot of money. Yeah, because to me, that's nothing.
Yeah, it's getting out of that tunnel, isn't it? The vision that we have.
Where
we look down or, you know, we don't engage. So these things that are shocking or, like, bring us outside of that are more and more important, I reckon. I don't know if, like, you're explaining how you're able to read people when you're in prison, and sort of maybe that opened your kind of senses to like what's around you. I guess, do you think that attached you to the idea of art as well in some respects, like that idea that, you know, you can suddenly go like that and you can see more, you can sort of engage more? And
well, that's what definitely got me into conceptual art.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I had no interest in art whatsoever when I went to prison.
Yeah.
And I think that what got me into art was finding that I discovered that I was potentially good at it. I could see a relationship between what I'd just put on the paper and what I was copying.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, oh, I've found something other than fucking crime and fighting that I'm, that I'm okay at, you know.
Yeah.
And then getting the tutor's sort of approval and, you know, that probably pushed me into art.
Cool.
But then it wasn't until you may well have heard me mention before, but I saw Mona Hatoum's sculpture called No Way 2 that had the nuts and bolts in the colander. Mm-hmm. It's when I discovered how to read conceptual art.
Yeah.
That's when it properly just pinged outwards.
Yeah.
And it really did sort of open up it opened up my fucking cell. You know, it's as if it took the firewall off the back of my prison cell. And, you know, I was the freest person in prison. It really was that sort of thing. That's why I refer to myself sometimes as a born-again artist. It's literally overnight, my fucking world changed. Yeah. It really did change.
I know exactly what you mean in some respects, because I don't think I've always liked art or understood it. And I think it's almost like a self-admittance, isn't it? It's like saying, actually, I get that now. And then as soon as you get it and you want to engage with it, then it opens up this whole world, doesn't it? Yeah. And I'm only really getting to grips with that in the last couple of years, I think.
It's amazing, this journey, isn't it?
Yeah, it's infinite, isn't it? There's no end to it, which is lovely.
Yeah, you're definitely...
There's no brief. There's no, like, yeah, end goal.
You're definitely being taken on a journey rather than taking a journey, aren't you, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because whenever I see a piece of artwork and it doesn't appeal to me, like visually, which, you know, is not every artwork's going to, you know, I just hope that there's something other than what's just been put on the canvas or, you know, what's been put in front of me. Yeah. And then sometimes that just having that little story behind it, that can just, you know, make the... Because it's me who's missed the story. It's not... Yeah. The artist hasn't done anything wrong. I've just not read it correctly, you know. Because it's, you know, it's all about sort of this visual language we're all putting out, and we've all got slightly different accents to our language, and sometimes you just don't pick up on it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, it's amazing in Britain, isn't it? I'm just talking about accents, how tiny it is as an island, and yet you can cross a border and there'll be a totally different lingo. I love that, and it's like art, isn't it? I mean, you can cross a little boundary and there'll be a totally different language in that, like, county of art, not literally, but like that sort of area of, which means there's just infinite different languages. And I mean,
everyone's convinced that their one is the Messiah. Right,
yeah, absolutely. That's such a human thing, isn't it? It's like,
Did you always have art at home growing up?
Yeah, I did. I mean, to be honest, I've never been able to do much apart from art and music. So it's kind of, it's quite easy. It was like, even through primary school, it was like, all I did was draw and play music, and that was it. And I'd never really, I kind of feel lucky because I've never had the choice.
Yeah, good.
You know, and my mum's a potter and her mum was an artist. So I suppose I've always been around it and just been really lucky that it was a kind of accepted thing, you know?
Yeah.
You think quite often it's not, isn't it? It's like, you know.
And has that aesthetic lineage gone into your children?
I don't know yet. He's six and he comes up with some pretty eccentric art. So maybe. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. Yeah, you could be the next Damien Hirst.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know. It's funny, isn't it? Because you don't want to force it on them either. It's like, they've got to do it for themselves. It's like, you know.
I gave up on my children. Yeah, I started. And when they started doing it, you know, when they put their mind to it.
Yeah.
You know, they was producing some really good drawings. You know, and this is, again, like you was just saying, when they was like six or seven. Like really, and it really surprised them. But then when they went upstairs, they'd forgotten about, you know, by the time they got to upstairs, that bit of, eagerness to draw had dissipated, you know. And
attention span of a flea.
Yeah, YouTube and Xbox
beat every time. Yeah, that's right.
But, who knows. They like coming to the exhibitions with me, you know, occasionally. Yeah,
such cool life for them as well. That's amazing. But
they only like the private views when there's, like, you know, the odd celebrity there or something you know.
Well,
they sort of float towards them and, you know, taking a selfie of themselves with someone in the background, you know.
They don't actually look at the art at all, just edge towards them.
When did you realise that you wanted to be an artist?
I think probably on my foundation. I did a foundation course at Chelsea and it was all about just a year of play.
Yeah.
And I just thought then, if you can make a career out of this, then that's a result.
Yeah, and I think everyone's got that mindset, haven't they?
Yeah. And I don't know, it's more and more I'm really passionate about the idea that creativity is what makes us human. So, you know, there's often a sort of separation in definition between art and science or maths or whatever, and I think they're all arts, you know. And so if we think more about linking everything, so especially at school, so art is as important as maths and science, then suddenly we're going to come up with creative solutions to everything. And it's like, sort of, I think we need to almost rethink definitions of stuff. Yeah. Art kind of floating around as its own thing at the moment. And I feel like it needs to be involved with other stuff. So I don't know how that relates to your question, just me going off on one. But we're so reliant, like definitions, don't we? Everything has a definition. There's a word attached to it. And then that object is a thing in itself.
Yeah.
And I teach a bit of experimental painting down at New Lynn School of Art. And it's about trying to get adults to get out of this idea of objectifying something, thinking
definitely
there's all this stuff around it. It's a 3D like imaginary entity around it. And then it becomes easier, doesn't it? It's like frees up another world attached to that thing. Your drawings are incredible. Like those little barbed wire drawings that I saw, they're so incredible and really powerful. So you've got that kind of like, they look sharp, but also they've got quite soft messages sometimes. It's a really cool idea. Well,
that's what I liked about them, and to tell you the truth, is that, like you was just saying about your artwork there, I like the idea that you can, it catches your eye from a distance because it doesn't quite look right. It looks like a fine drawing, but you know it's not a fine drawing, you know, because it's got a lot of visual texture about it. And it's not until you get up close that you see it's, you know, these tally marks. And then you realise it's the time series, and it's just that, like you were saying, just that unfolding or, you know, taking off each skin of the onion, you know. And that's all, that's all down to, I've just finished one just last night, actually. Fucking head in. and you can't, when you're working on them, you know, obviously at sort of quite close, and my eyes are shit anyway, so I've got to get quite close to them. And you can be, I'll be doing it for an hour, and I have no idea whether it's worked or not until I sort of tape it to the wall, have a look, and I go, oh yeah, that's looking all right. I need to get a pair of backwards binoculars or something, you know.
It's a bit of a journey. I bet you they start really positively, like with raising energy, and then about half an hour in, you're like, oh, fucking hell, I've got another.
And I can, it takes me about half hour to sort of get into the mindset to start them because they're so monotonous, you know. So that's where podcasts come in. I put into my ears because I've always put headphones in. that's where a podcast cracks on, and I just sort of, I'm just numb for a couple of hours, you know.
It's like that, isn't it? I mean, I'll be in the studio painting, and I know that school pick, I've got to leave at 3 for pick up, whatever. And 3 o'clock comes around in about 5 minutes. It's like, I'll get all my stuff out, start painting, and then before I know it, it's kind of, I've missed it, and he's at the gateway. I arrive covered in paint.
It's teacher's dropping him off to you at 10 to 5.
There you go.
Which piece that you've created, then, do you think has got the strongest emotional connection?
I think public art-wise, the To All at Sea shipwreck piece, because it was so layered and everyone involved in it was emotional for different reasons. So there was this kind of collective thing about it, which was really lovely. And because it was about emotive subjects and it was in the context of the place, it had loads of layers of emotion. When I had to do this little speech during the performance of the music, and I just kind of lost it. I was sobbing at the front of me. Which meant everyone else started off, and it was like, it was stunning. Not because of the painting or anything, just because of the
feeling that it's, like you mentioned earlier about the energy that can come from an art of work, from a work of art. And I'm a strong believer that if you put energy into something, I'm not a very spiritual person, but.
Yeah.
You can feel a power emanating from an artwork. The one I'm working on at the moment, I don't sort of publicise these. I do these a little bit private, really. But I do, most of my padlocks are closed padlocks because it's meant to be trying to achieve a resolution that you're working on. It might be depression or whatever. Yeah. You're trying to battle your way through something. And I like the idea that it can possibly, with a little bit of, it's like picking a lock, you know. If you do it for long enough and try hard enough, it's possible that you'll break it and open it and succeed. So that's why they're all locked. But what I do for friends and family, and as I say, I don't really put this out there, but I do an open padlock. And that'd be, I do that for if someone's suffered a loss in their family, you know. And while I'm doing those, and because they're all, done with, black pen, I'll put in there on, I'll work out how many days that person's been alive. And it's generally an elderly person. So it's normally about sort of 40,000 or so, you know.
It's a massive padlock.
it is generally, you'd be surprised how much you can fit them in. It's normally about sort of around about 22 centimetres.
Wow.
That's all it is, you know. 52 centimetres.
Yeah.
That's when they're open. And yeah, the marks, when I'll be counting them, I'll have a little clicky, you know, like the doorman used to have in the nightclub.
Yeah.
I've got one of those, so I'll mark every one. And when I get like to their 18th birthday, I'll put a little red mark, for instance.
Oh, amazing, yeah.
On their wedding day, I'll put, because I'm trying to make it to be every day of that person's life.
Mm.
And the last one, the very last mark, is in the centre of the padlock, but I leave the mark out. So you can see a white gap. And that's where they didn't finish that day, you know.
Incredible.
But while I'm doing that, I will often, I'll either listen to something that I know that the friend is, you know, is into or likes, or something their mum or dad liked, or the person in question, so that I would sort of try and get all of that energy.
Yeah,
but I'm sure that all that energy of thinking of that person is going to emanate.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a whole package, isn't it, of all of those things coming together. I love the layering of that project as well, and all the detail of it, and the kind of, yeah, it's incredible. Wow.
Yeah. So
it's like total immersion, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels that way. I just want the world to realize how interesting and layered they are, you know? It's hard getting, you know, yourself, it's hard getting a message out there, and it's not until people's ears start pricking up. Yeah. What do you do to relax, Ant?
I play a lot of music, play piano a lot. I surf. I don't know if I do relax. actually, painting, really. Like I do get quite bad waves of depression about things. And if I engage with the world too much, like sort of big issues that I can't do anything about, then I go on a downhill. But if I paint, like yesterday, I feel amazing afterwards. Because it's kind of self-affirming somehow.
Yeah.
So in a weird way, painting actually is probably my thing.
I mean, you're not the only one to be affected by things out of their control, and I don't know whether that's because of the creative mind, because you're always trying to, you know, a painting is just like a puzzle sort of thing, isn't it?
You
know, you're trying to achieve the outcome, whereas when things happen that you have no control over, I mean, I've always been a strong person, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard me mention on a couple of podcasts, but my son, round about this time last year, got diagnosed with a rare cancer.
Oh, no, right. Sorry.
And
it
was the fact that I've always been a sort of, well, I've always seen myself as a strong sort of centre of the world, you know, making everything right for it, making sure everything's good for everyone. Then all of a sudden, he's got that, and it is totally out of my control.
Mm.
I felt myself spiralling, and then I had to sort of play it that I'm not getting depressed because that's when the fucking family have absolutely needed me. Do you know what I mean? And that was a strange thing to see myself falling down like that, and you know, it's not even be able to see the floor.
You want to grab it and take control of it, but it's not like that, is it? And there's no way you can plan for something like that either, is there? Like mentally, because you just don't know.
Yeah, and when we finally got the all clear, which was a few months later. That was it then. It was literally, as soon as we got that phone call, it was like the fucking weights were being taken off of my shoulders, you know?
Yeah.
It's absolutely bonkers. You mentioned about you enjoy your public artwork.
Yeah.
The Kensington and Chelsea Art Show, which I've been concentrating on throughout this month.
Yeah.
You are... a part of that. You're in a bit of a limbo at the moment.
Yeah, we're just doing a few technical issues. But yeah, I was really chuffed to be part of it, and it's such a cool thing. I love the fact that that whole area comes alive with all these interruptions to normal life, and a wicked team that put so much energy into it as well.
And what was it you was going to put into that?
So that was called Wild Words, and it's basically a way of making grass die temporarily. And messages appear in the grass, and these were messages about natural recovery, and it was kind of timed, you know, after COVID and maybe our relationship with nature and all of those things. So I basically heat up quite gently a steel alphabet and then lay them on the grass, leave them there for a few minutes. The grass obviously dies, but it dies over sort of 3 days. So initially the quotes are invisible, and then over the next 2 days they appear.
Brilliant.
And then as the grass recovers over about 2-3 weeks, the quotes then disappear, and obviously nature takes back over.
Nice.
So we had like quotes from 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds amongst quotes from Lem Sissé, Rob McFarlane, you know, some famous
words. Wow. Yeah.
There's an opportunity for these kids to be shown in an artwork alongside, you know, some big names in nature. So it's quite a simple concept really, but just a way of presenting the written word in a different way.
How and why did that temporarily not come about?
Yeah, we're just finding some new locations at the moment, but I think the parks were a little bit worried about the grass and the recovery of it, which is kind of quite a nice extra bit of story really, because it's kind of about that and our relationship with grass as a human thing as well. It does actually recover very quickly, but I can understand that if, you know, people haven't seen something or tried it, there's a bit of anxiety around the impact.
It's almost as if they're refusing to listen to the visual words, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I've obviously tested it loads, so it works, and it recovers very easily. I mean, grass almost recovers too easily. It's like, you know, it's like a carpet.
And I did a couple of years ago, just maybe a year before COVID hit, I had the sense that text was just coming so much into the art world from all directions, you know. Mm. Robert Montgomery, I don't know if you know Robert Montgomery, you know, he makes text in neon, but places them in urban locations, you know, like mobile.
There's something about stumbling across things like that changes the message, doesn't it? It makes them stronger.
Definitely.
Because you read them more slowly, you kind of engage with them more. But yeah, absolutely.
How many different pieces of text did you have?
There were 10. So we had a load of submissions. Then we picked 10, and they ranged from like ancient naturalists from, you know, like John Muir to, you know, kids to current famous wordsmiths. So it's about the fact that we've always had this relationship with nature and the recovery of nature as well. So, there were 10 in total. But it's something that I'd like to do whole poems of, you know, down banks.
Yeah. Yeah, nice.
And make a bit of a performance of it as well. So maybe the scorching and the branding is part of that. So cinematically, it could work quite well. So it's just the start of an idea. There's a beautiful new installation, the Tate Turbine Hall. I don't know if you saw it, where they did the opposite actually, and grew a word in a big kind of grass bed and then floated it down the Thames.
I just saw that yesterday, funnily enough. They was walking it down towards the river's beach to let it go. Yeah, it's beautiful.
But you're right. I think there is a trend towards more word-orientated installations, and that's quite nice. I think the written words become really important in lockdown. Like a lot of people have got into poetry and reading and
definitely
a bit of cathartic stuff. So, yeah, it's cool.
And, yeah, I mean, a beautiful bit of text, it can stay with someone forever, can't it, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, people hold them, don't they? And it's quite an easy thing to kind of take in and remember as well. I like the kind of crossover as well between when does that word become an image or when does it become a sculpture? Yeah. So if you put it in that context outdoors, is it a word still or is it an image?
Is it graffiti?
Exactly, yeah, grass-feety. <I like that. laughs>
So you've not found locations yet for it.
No, the team are doing an amazing job at just finding alternative. It was 10 public parks, but I think the grass struggles a bit in the parks anyway, so they're a bit reluctant in the end to do that. So it will happen. So
I mean, there was someone that I know, I won't mention his name because he went under a different name doing this, but he would have a stencil and a higher pressure jet wash, and he'd put the stencil down over just normal pavements in a shopping centre with a pressure washer. He'd sort of run it across the open part of the stencil, pull it away, and it's not graffiti because it's just cleaned.
Yeah. So doing this, a favor.
I don't know where he would have would have gone legally, because as I say, it's not
real style. Yeah.
Not graffiti. And I don't think you can be arrested for cleaning an area. well, you never know nowadays, that's for sure. You never
know. The only way to get rid of it is to clean everything else around it.
That's if great. There was, and if there was you and 5 other artists, past and present, what would your ideal group show be?
Oh wow, be pretty eclectic. I think Anselm Kiefer.
Oh, yeah.
Richard Serra.
You're going for some big guns.
Yeah, is this something I go and look at? Or
no, it's an art exhibition of you and five other artists.
Oh, bloody hell, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, they might not be up for that.
No, they'll be up for it. It's your ideal group show, so okay, anyone's in it.
Richard Long.
Nice.
Cy Twombly. And, of course, tricky.
It'll change tomorrow.
Actually, there's a cool Cornish painter whose work I love, Sam Bassett, who's working currently. Probably him as well.
Oh, nice. And what does he do seascapes?
No, he does kind of autobiographical abstract paintings, but he's on fire. I think his work's amazing. And he's got a really strong voice. You used to have a chat with him, actually. He's amazing.
Oh, I was just writing his name down for exactly that.
Sam Bassett. But I just think as a painter, he's got a really powerful language, which is really hard to achieve and something, you know, I'd love to get to eventually.
And how did you come by him?
I met him through teaching in Cornwall. So there's a bit of a cool scene going on now in Cornwall again. So the Newlyn and St Ives thing's happening and
nice.
There's a cool group of more contemporary and braver painters and sculptors going on. So, yeah, there's stuff going on there, which is great.
Those studios down on the St Ives Beach.
Oh, yeah. Hawthmore Studios, yeah.
Oh, man, they are amazing.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah. We
And just the heritage there as well is amazing, isn't it? Like, history and the people that have been there and, yeah.
Yeah, when I went down to that beach years and years ago, when me and my partner first got together, before we was, you know, anchored down with the bloody kids, I went onto that beach. And I knew that they was around, I knew that they was in St Ives, but I had no idea where. And I just looked up and I thought, oh, that would be make a great studio.
Yeah, yeah.
And then discovered that it was. And when you go in the studios, man, you'd pay £1 million for that apartment, wouldn't you, with that view.
Amazing. I love the fact they're still studios. It's brilliant. And they always will be. But it sounds weird, but I love the smell of a studio.
Yeah,
just that smell of paint. It almost kind of really hits me here because it reminds me of like foundation course and just that, you know, the smell of the studio is amazing, isn't it?
Well, that's what I missed about doing these podcasts over Zoom.
People smell.
Yeah, the smell of a human. But no, going into the studio, because even if I didn't know the artist, I'd turn up into their studio and I'd do absolutely minimal, you know, background on an artist, even if I don't know them, because as I said, it's that chance meeting and the conversation starting is what I like, and the discovery. But yeah, going into an artist studio and just sort of having a nose round, sort of picking up all these little clues like some sort of detective, you know.
Exactly. Amazing. Yeah.
The one that's out at the moment is Zach Ove. I don't know if you know.
Oh, yeah, I love that. Pile of Cars is incredible.
When I went to his, it's not his studio. He was at MDM Props, which is a great big. Do you know MDM Props?
Yeah, I know it is.
So I went down to there, and I'd always wanted to go there as well.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah.
Because he said, we could go away to somewhere more quiet, just so that there might be a bit of ambient noise. Mm. I said, no, fuck it. We was right at the doorway, and it was where the workers at lunchtime they come out and have their lunch at this table, you know. And he said, right, well, we can do it here, but we have to be away by like 12:15 or whatever it was, because they will just push it. They will just pick our stuff up and, you know, because that's where they have their dinner, you know.
Yeah.
And
wicked.
Yeah. And it was all them noises and banging and crashing going on around us. Yeah, it was great.
There's something quite kind of like Neanderthal about it, isn't it? Just people making stuff. It's it's bashing and like, sort of, I don't know. Brilliant. It reminds me of when, you know, when you go down to the Jurassic Coast and there's people trying to find fossils.
Yeah.
The beach full of people with hammers whacking rocks. Like cavemen. Got rock. Found fossil.
Oh, I was one of those with the kids. Yeah. We've got a, yeah, we've got a billion years worth of fossils just stuck in the bedroom, you know. Yeah, now we feel guilty about taking a piece of fossilised history and just banging it in the drawer upstairs because you don't know what to do with it.
A loft full of dinosaurs.
And if you wasn't an artist, what would you like to be?
Probably some kind of environmentalist or like, I don't know. Yeah, there's a cool program going on in Plymouth at the moment, which is about planting seagrass again.
It's been
ripped up for so many generations. Something like that, which is kind of some kind of planting or growing thing. Or a pianist, musician.
One of the two.
Yeah.
You say the seagrass has been ripped up. Do you mean naturally ripped up or...
No, so it's like, you know,
people and animals.
100 years of anchoring boats and all that stuff.
Oh, I've got you.
Seagrass is really important, CO2 tap. So, I love that idea that you're kind of regrowing something, starting something again, and, you know, which is going to be important, I think, the next 20 years.
from now on, I think.
Now to the infinity, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, a couple of trees in the Amazon wouldn't go amiss, would they?
Yeah, I know, right? Exactly.
What have you got coming up, Hank?
So I'm doing a sort of ongoing show at the moment for a gallery in Manchester, which is about fictional travel. Wild Words, I'm going to kind of take forward a wee bit. I'm going to go and reclaim the To All at Sea stuff as well, so the old elements from that, and reinvent it into something else. I'm spending a bit more time in the studio, getting back into painting again now. And another mass, I'm trying to organize different mass painting things, which obviously can't happen at the moment. And that's how I met the Kensington Chelsea guys originally. We were going to do a mass painting installation in Holland Park.
Brilliant.
About planting trees. The idea is we get more and more people each time. So you get, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. I'd love to do one with school kids. So linking up school kids and painting. Maybe we could do one with prisoners, like do a portrait project, or, you know, get as many thousand people as possible all drawing or painting at the same time. I don't know, too many ideas, not enough time.
But you saying that about doing it with prisoners, as part of a workshop, I'd go into prisons, do my little fucking bit of spiel, and then taking a paint by numbers,
it'd
only be sort of like half a dozen tones, but you know, halfway through they realize it's going to be Tupac or whomever, you know.
Yeah, cool.
And it all comes together, so they've all I've got half a dozen pots of paint, and they'll all be doing a little bit. And I thought, oh, it'll bring everyone together. No way.
Like a race.
Yeah, get out of my fucking way. Pass me that. Who's got the number two painter? Fucking hell, man. And, you know, no one's polite. No one's got any fucking manners to each other. They've got that much fucking fuse, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the old me has to kick in.
Yeah.
Which I refer to as Roy Maynard. he pops in and puts his fucking foot down, you know, because... Yeah. Anyone else would just get walked over, you know, trying to be polite to these guys.
And then
all of a sudden it's like, bang the fucking table and like, fucking leave it alone. You know, they're all right with that, you know.
Wicked, yeah.
Trying to sort of harmonise a load of prisoners.
Yeah, I can imagine, it's pretty like a utopian thing that's not going
to
happen.
Yeah, it's hard work to try and get everyone on board, you know, because they're all rebels anyway at heart.
Like, you know? The reality check of like everyone painting a flower in prison.
And where can anyone see your work, be it website or social media?
Well, my website is agarrett, GARRT.com. Or Instagram is Anthony Garrett, ANTHONYGARRT.
Excellent.
It's a mixture. I mean, it's all a bit out of date, actually, because I'm hopeless at keeping things up to date in that department. But having said that, I'll do it this afternoon.
No time like the present. Well, and that's all my questions asked.
Oh, well, thanks so much for the yabba, Gary. Real pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, it's good fun. I'll see you later on, mate.
Cheers.
Bye. There you go, Anthony Garrett. Didn't I tell you his artwork was full of empathy? And how beautiful was his All at Sea piece? And as I mentioned there, you can see more of his work over on his website, which is agarrett.com. Or over on his Instagram, which is _Anthony_Garrett_. I reckon there was already a couple of Anthony Garretts on Instagram before he joined, didn't you?
I know this has been a quick intro and outro. That's because I had quite a bit of work on this week, which I will mention in a further episode, but I've fallen behind in the editing, so I'm off to do that now. So until the next episode, toodle-pip. Well, hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. If you're unable to support us on Patreon, leaving a review on whichever platform you listen to this podcast really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast, or even giving us a positive shout-out on your social media. Anything is appreciated, but either way, thanks for listening, and until next week, ta-da.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.